Hi, I'm Emma Cousin, an artist in Southeast London, and I started this podcast to keep us artists in touch under lockdown. I wanted to talk to other artists about their impact on the artistic community and explore what's changed, what's lost, and what's been discovered. In this episode, Louise Ashcroft and I talk about tourist yoga and embracing liveness as a strategy in this new, less socially intense space of lockdown. Louise talks about faking liveness, walking tutorials and collage as walking, wondering the things she's wondering. We talk about sculpture jokes, pace and making things structurally unsafe so that things can come together unexpectedly. We talk about starting with writing, post-it notes, expensive words and extending language. We discuss getting bored quickly, Franz Hal, and how to change the accent of a slogan. Louise gets into how art and comedy overlap, boring talks and using the Argos catalogue and a residency in a shopping centre to build a narrative of what's really going on. We talk about joy and rage, about generosity and resistance, and freedom as a muscle to be flexed. We talk about education, or as Louise calls it, utopia, about alt MFA, about making your own art school, and working with and within an institution. Louise demonstrates improvisation live and takes us around the back of Asda, through her head and into ours. We end on cycling to ET and being perfectly primed to make something out of nothing. Thank you for joining us for Chats with Artists Under Lockdown. Hello, Louise Ashcroft.
Hello, Emma.
How are you doing?
Good, yeah. I just tried yoga for the first time, so I'm feeling both energized and kind of relaxed.
Nice. Was that the first time?
Well, I did try it in India on holiday, but it wasn't so successful. It was fun, but yeah, I tried it like properly for an hour this time, not in a tourist way, but in a serious way. And yeah, I like it. I think it's really important that I'm embodied and active. That's been one of the main saviors of lockdown for me, is moving.
Yeah, definitely. Well, physical. I love the idea of tourist yoga though. Like, we should all start doing tourist yoga. Because I think obviously with your performance artist, which I always think sounds really weird. You're a live artist. I don't know how you want to.
I don't know how to describe it. It's probably performance that I'm most known for, but yeah. A lot of the time that becomes a video, or a lot of the time that's a piece of writing that had to be shown in some way that was more like visceral than the piece of writing, because basically people don't read writing because nobody can concentrate for long enough, so you have to ram it down their throats by making it live. So more the liveness is a strategy for making alive the thing that I've made, which is often something else, and sometimes that gets recorded and sometimes it's performed without mediation as an actual live event.
Yeah. And we'll talk about some of your live events, which will have many different forms and bodies and platforms and groups of collaborations as well. But in terms of that liveness, then, how are you coping, in the kind of disembodied sense of being on Zooms and being in your kitchen, and where are you now, and how has your practice changed? How is your making and your methodology, how has all that shifted?
Well, it's been quite nice to be in a less socially intense space, because I'm quite shy, so I get a bit overstimulated by in-life contact. And I love it and I thrive off it, but the adrenaline of, say, a whole day of giving tutorials, by the end of that day, I'll have bitten all my fingernails off and I'll be able to cry. But I'll be bouncing and I love every second of it. But yeah, it's a bit different having slightly more time, because you don't have to get to work, and in my own practice, being a little bit more maybe in control. Like if something goes out live, then there's a possibility of sort of faking some of that liveness and editing it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel like it's quite good for my extrovert introvert personality, but yeah. I'm really missing my friends and hanging out, and I'm really missing my students, seeing them in real life. But I'm gonna see one of my students for a walking tutorial because she lives quite near, so socially distant physical tutorial, which will be yeah. really. So yeah, like it's kind of really great, but also some things I'm starting to miss now.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, I love that idea of a walking tutorial. I think there's all, like, always that idea of like walking therapy, like walking and talking. You get to a lot more places than you do when you're just looking at each other, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. So much part of my practice. I've never really had a studio, even at times where I could have had a studio, even a free studio. I've always just used it as a place to put my bag and then go on a walk and notice things, because observation is so much part of what I do. It's the first part of the process for me, so I kind of have to get up and go into the world, even if that's like it might not be the world, it might be the internet, or it might be the street, it could be a site that's specific, like a museum or something, but yeah. I never just be within my own head. I always have to go out there. So yeah, like wandering, whatever the thing is that I'm wandering, and field work, they're all like really key. So yeah, like I think walking is super important.
That's interesting. I hadn't really perceived that before, that you were kind of a gatherer in that sense, that you don't, I mean, the idea of not being static makes total sense, but I like that idea of walking as part of your practice.
Yeah, it's like that's great.
Your studio. Yeah, I like that a lot. Really interesting. And it also gives permission to it. I mean, like, I'm walking to the studio, I'm finding that permission to spend that time doing it is really interesting, and really opening up different kind of, I don't know, things you perceive on the way, or notice or see or take in or taste or smell, or like, I don't know, little things.
Yeah.
Feed in, don't they?
How far away is the studio from your house?
It's like an hour walk, 50 minutes.
Really? Wow, that's really cool, actually, to have that time.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it feels really luxurious. I am a bit like, I could cycle and this is really fast, but this feels necessary. So not always, but sometimes, like definitely just under lockdown, I've very rarely done it before. I don't know. It's like you say, it's getting into your body and sort of moving it. Moving your body is way more important somehow.
You see stuff that you, like, stuff happens. You're like open up to like, some kind of synchronicity or something. Sounds really hippie, but like maybe secretly it is, like but just kind of allowing chance to happen. I think that's a really important thing in my work. It probably is in your work as well.
I think it's making me think a lot about how you've described using collage, or you make collage as well, but that idea of bringing disparate things together and putting them on a desk, and, you know, or bringing them together in a room, or I know you have a room full of objects, for instance. So I just wondered if that has something to do with this idea of collecting information and then collaging it together. So the walking is part of the collage, essentially.
Yeah. Well, like, a walk is just a collage because you're walking through, your eyes are making a live collage as your attention shifts to different things and what you notice. And I was brought up always being told, oh, look at that, and little stories about different things that were just whatever was there. So everything became interesting, and it's, my practice is pretty much an extension of having stuff pointed out and asking what's that, and even like the interesting table in school and things. Create a narrative through a collage of observations and then trying to find links between those observations. So like, I was listening to I think it was Rebecca Solnit, so obviously she writes about walking, but it was about another book. She was talking on the radio about her process, and that was observation, introspection, and flights of fancy. And so, like, for me, that's also true. It's the observation is the kind of collecting of the collage material, and then the introspection is, right, let's figure out if there's some link here, or how we could really like force a link, or like make an unexpected connection between the things. And then the kind of flight of fancy bit is how you then reread that new iteration and you kind of create another reality. I think like the real world is really important to my work, so like everyday life and things that are existing formats of, you know, whether that's like a collection in a museum or whether that is the newspaper of that day. Like I like to take like primary, or well, maybe they're not primary sources, I guess they're not, I don't understand. Yeah, I quit A-level history, but these sources that feel like they're not already processed by me, and then processing them and then kind of like rereading them as if they were real. So almost like conspiracy theory type extrapolation of that reality once you've reconfigured it. So it's all collage, but often that collage takes the form of a performance or a text, or it might be a physical collage or a joke, even like a kind of like a joke or a concept which has this subversive flip of a given reality or two which are set up against each other, as happens in lots of jokes. You get like this kind of leading you in one direction, like what's black and white and red all over? Oh, a newspaper, because the word red is also means to like reading. So yeah, like the University of Reading, I always like seeing that, because it's obvious it's a university, you know. But so yeah, like just like puns and flips of meaning, and that happens in comedy all the time. And I think that's a sort of part of collage that I really, really enjoy.
Yeah, yeah. There's so much there that I feel like we could go forward with it, in terms of like there's something about even the way you've jumped from like walking to collage to observation to like existing formats, newspapers, conspiracy theory, jokes, and then flipping meaning. Like language, comedy, there's so much kind of going on, and pace, like even the way you the speed you move through these things. I've always been a bit obsessed with how that comes into the work, that kind of the frequency aspect, like it's dialed up to some extent. And you've talked about like ranting as a word specifically, like a sculptural comedy rant. And I just wonder if you could talk a bit about pace, because I feel like that's such an important bit. If you ever see Louise live, like I've seen you perform and or be on stage, be with you live, and there's a real like I'm heightened, like everything's like it's getting faster and faster and it's all going to fall apart, but it sort of doesn't. And there's something about the even your spoken poetry, the spoken writing, the writing you read has this essence of pauses, but then it's I guess it's that high frequency I'm interested in.
Yeah, I never really noticed that. I feel like, or maybe I kind of noticed the pacing and the pace and the fact that there's an excess of things that are thrown at the audience or the reader, and that then there's this frantic trying to like make sense of them or give them some structure. And once I was writing an essay, I think it was on my BA, and I think it was on my Birkbeck Cultural Studies MA, and the tutor described it as like structurally unsafe, like actually like a health and safety issue that this thing would fall down. And so I think like structure is something that I've always struggled with, being like dyspraxic and ADHD or whatever the things that I might have used to get free computers. But all those, the way that like brains work are different, and mine has a very kind of alternative kind of structuring going on. And that means that I have to be super, super tight and organized about things and almost obsessively categorize and refine. And so that's why I really like conceptual one-liners. But then there's also this attraction to chaos and a multiplicity of different things going on at the same time and trying to kind of like juggle them. So it's like, I think of my work a bit like, so conceptual artists from the 70s that might make like one idea really simply, like Robert Smithson or something, like the it would be okay that you could just like pour some asphalt or something and it would be like, that's the idea. Or like a Lawrence Wiener thing that would be like, let's throw a marker pen into the sea and that's it. I love all that, and I love people like Francis Elise who and just like only talking about white men now, I'm aware.
I was thinking that, I was like,
so yeah, but like people like Francis Elise or like Sophie Cal, this idea that you're like, I'm gonna follow a stranger, or like a Francis Elise piece where you might like, well, I'm gonna walk across a border and I will like record that by dripping paint. I love all of those conceptual one-liners, and they're kind of like little sculpture jokes, but I do those but with 100 of them going on at the same time, and that's the kind of the difference, I guess. And so the pace comes from the need to make that possible, that they could all coexist. And I think then the surprise and the excitement for me comes from what happens when they like cross-pollinate and breed and have this big kind of like, not how humans reproduce, but like maybe how some other thing, I don't know what, reproduces, where it's like a collective endeavor, which is maybe like how like memes as opposed to genes, or maybe even genes, because bits and the illusion of wholeness is like in your paintings, there's no one body, like each body leads to another, and we're not quite sure which arm is our own. Like, it might be someone else's and it moves, and you're like, oh, the horror kind of being on the tube and like realizing that someone else's foot is your foot and their hand isn't, you know, that kind
of. It's instantly making think of like Phantom Limb and Out on a Limb and all the like really. The really funny limb puns as well.
Yeah, definitely Phantom Limbs. Like, so I'm not sure why we're talking about that.
I think we've got to that idea of stretching language too, because it feels like even to describe, you know, the 70s kind of conceptual artists as sculpture jokes is doing something linguistically that's funny, but also forming another structure and another system. So I think language, maybe you could just talk a bit about how important language is and why it's become like the main thing, maybe that like you say, you're writing more than anything. So
yeah, it starts with writing, and then the writing, it might be like, oh, this is a performance, oh, this is a film, it will be have a narrative voiceover. If there's a film, there's pretty much always a really tightly crafted piece of text that started off as something really sprawling and like kind of like, I really enjoy writing live, and if that's on stage, that's one way of writing live, but there's also just feeling like you're writing really intuitively and really fast, like when you're sitting down and writing or standing up and writing. I often write on 1,000 post-it notes or loads of piles of old flyers that I've got hanging around, writing on the back of those and having them all over the house. So I think like the actual physical act of writing for me is quite has a liveness about it. But then the good thing about being able to refine it, if you're not on stage, you get this secondary bit where you can kind of process it and filter, and then you can like tighten. And every time you've gone to a word that's obvious or a kind of phrase that's obvious, you're like, right, I have to switch that word because it's lazy and it's also like cheap. Whereas you can have an expensive word for free. Like, why not have an expensive word? I try and even just make up a word if there isn't a word there. Like, it, translation's super interesting. And I recently had to translate a film into Dutch. I don't speak Dutch. It would be amazing to, because I wrote the text and then somebody at the museum translated it. really nicely. And I loved it because I knew that he'd actually read it properly, which is like the most attentive anyone could ever be to your work. So it felt really luxurious. And so he gave me back the translation, but I had to put the subtitles in where I thought they should go. And obviously not speaking Dutch, that was quite a challenge. Like, yeah, it was really interesting to see how a translation, there might be like a whole new term in Dutch that we don't have in English. So like sometimes maybe we have to take responsibility for extending the possibilities of language, because it's kind of all we've got. Depressingly, like we can't communicate a feeling. We're like limited to this sort of approximation through these characters that are letters. But then also it's the opposite of limiting. It's kind of like, oh wow, everything is possible for free. I just have to say things. I don't even need to think of it, because if you take a newspaper, cut it up, and like I've done this exercise loads of times with like schools groups and things like that in during like family residencies and like schools residencies and things at arts organizations. But if you take a newspaper and you just cut it up into like the nouns and the adjectives and whatever else you want, you just stick it together and suddenly you've got like a really exciting narrative that you'd never have come to. You don't have to come up with it, you can just find it and bring it together.
Yeah, and I think that alongside the observational a part of your practice is like the where the tension comes from, I guess, for maybe.
Yeah.
Are there any other exercise like that you do like as a routine or as a regular thing? Like, I don't know, I'm thinking about people who do like write the morning page and they sit down for an hour and free write, or is there anything like you go to if you're maybe not even if you're stuck, just as a way to like get into things, or any routine or ritual writing that you always do?
There's loads that I don't like stick to them all, so I'll get bored really quickly if I feel like I have to do it. So I'll do things like I use my voice memos loads on my phone. So I will speak to either the camera or to the voice memo and just record a total stream of consciousness. I really like speaking as writing, so just talking and then going through it's really time consuming because you have to go through all of the fluff in order to just get a few gems. But yeah, that also, even sometimes if I'm doing a workshop that's a kind of performance workshop, I might try out a technique. So I did something fairly recently. I used this magazine called Stuff Magazine, which is a consumer like gadget magazine. And we took all the descriptions of products from that magazine. So you had like these amazing, ridiculous, like 360 plasma tech core, whatever. And like the language is so like sort of seductive. And like these people who are writing it have probably done English literature degrees. And that when I walk through the supermarket, like there's poetry on, there's frustrated poets on the back of every product. So yeah, like I like to take descriptions and kind of appropriate. I think appropriation has become a dirty word. And yeah, I can see how like cultural appropriation, there's loads of bad stuff about that depending on how it's done. But there's also something that you can do that can like be a bit naughty with power by appropriating. So like the last piece of work that I made that was sort of a big-ish work was this film for Frans Hals Museum in Haarlem in the Netherlands. And then I started by taking images from their collection off their website, because the show is called Image Power and it's about sort of institutional critique through the image. And so I kind of nicked images from their website of all their collection, which goes from the 17th century right up until now, with amazing works in it. And from those images, I just tried to almost like caption them myself or think up a narrative or try and like sort of without knowing anything about them all, work out what they were doing. And then I tried to put them together somehow, and that ended up being woven into a full narrative. So it's kind of like if you were doing a pub quiz and you had to caption the image, but doing that and taking it really far, and then like, okay, we've got two images with captions, so what's the link between these? And then, yeah, it became a half-hour story of this. It was about a character who's in one of the paintings, one of the 17th century paintings. He's like an officer of some kind of civic guard thing. And he's got a really good beard. And I wanted to think about, like, obviously the 17th century in Holland is the origin of global capitalism and colonialism, and they're kind of living at that time where trade gives way, like normal kind of trade, just sort of as a way of sharing things, gives way to this like crazy capitalism where there's sort of serious violence and unsustainability attached to it. So I wanted to go back to that point and think, oh, who's this character and what life might he have now, and has anything changed? And so the character, he's called Nicholas. He goes, he becomes a JPEG because he's been uploaded, and he then has this life on the internet as a beard preneur, like a beard oil preneur, and he makes an app which is to share his privilege, and so he's sort of a tech entrepreneur, and but like the app goes wrong because he's trying to like basically make people into him by sharing his DNA. It's like a dystopian bit of literature, I suppose. Or it isn't literature, it's like
it could be. I mean, it's a bit like, I mean, I like the idea of it. You said like a live bit of writing, like spoken writing, but I guess that idea of the audiobook is, you know, when you watch them, there's like, it is a level of being talked through a narrative, so there is that aspect there, the literature thing, but yeah, it's just a lot more complicated. Maybe it's not giving you everything that easily.
Yeah, I really like audiobooks. that's how I read books, and I really like Radio 4, and I go through phases where I'm like, oh, Radio 4, do I really love it? But then ultimately I always learn so much about things, and it's not like stuffy, like it isn't what people think it is. It's actually like super diverse, super like woke, and yeah, like way more up to date with things. It's doing really radical stuff. So I think radio and audiobooks are mega important. Like I love listening to Olivia Lang, and I love listening to she's called Michelle T. Like I listened to some stuff by her, like kind of like funny, clever, postmodern, if that even is a thing, writing that is about like right now. Like I think we should make work about like right now, this exact second, even if it's about the 17th century as well.
And is that what you were thinking? So you were trying to make, I mean, it's interesting from a painterly sense, like bringing 17th century painting into the 21st century and bringing it in a physical sense, like this, what would that be now, how would it live in? And it's not a painting on a wall, right? It's a JPEG, like he becomes this character that gets stuck in a system, sort of. And it makes me think about glitches and even what painting, like are you sort of trying to challenge those kind of traditional mediums as well, or is it something else?
I suppose it's just about really how I live and what is, I'm always trying to challenge something or like do something in the wrong language to see how it changes. Like, because I think then imagine if you had like, imagine if like Nigella Lawson had like a Bolton accent or something, like that would totally change her. Like, so what happens if you just shift? Like, I did a project in 2017 with Arbeit Gallery, and as part of that, it was a residency in Westfield Shopping Centre that was not.
I came. It was.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, you were there. Oh my gosh, that was like the best thing ever. You were part of one of the like retail therapy sessions where we used the shopping centre as a kind of studio space for loads of creative exercises. That was so fun. And yeah, like, as part of that project, because there was a boating community right next to the Westfield, and I got really interested in the way that the language on the T-shirts in the shopping centre sort of contrasted with, but also was really similar to some of the language on the narrow boats. So some of the names that were written on the sides of the narrow boats. There was lots of T-shirts that said things like dreamer and like ideas of escapism, and loads of kind of connections were there with this, the rebelliousness of the boating community that has kind of opted out in a certain way. So sometimes there were total contrasts, but, and I thought that they would be so different, like the language of fast fashion, because that was the slogan T-shirt era, where every piece of clothing was just a basic thing, but with like a kind of hashtag type statement on it. And so, yeah, but I found that by translating, so what I did was got a load of people and taught them, so like members of the public were taught how to do traditional enamel boat sign painting. I didn't know how to do it, but I got this boat sign painter to help us. And we wrote some of the slogans from the T-shirts, which I'd collected. In this, we kind of translated them into this style of boat painting. So we ended up with like an enamel boat style paintings in saying slogans from the T-shirts that felt much more like contemporary. But actually, like that was just like, how do we change the accent of something? Essentially, how do we speak the voice of one thing through the voice of another thing? And what happens if we do that? But there were loads of similarities, so it almost wasn't as discordant as I expected.
Yeah, which actually it feels like it brings it back a little bit to the Franz Hal connection, in that like I immediately thought with Franz Hal, like he's all about like vitality, freeness of gesture, but freeness also in terms of like an egalitarian sense of who he paints. Like he's quite irreverent and he does paint famous people, but he's also painting like the village idiot, and a lot of the best paintings, a lot of ones that are so delicious, juicy, fierce, like brave, they're the ones that have this, like they capture the life of the underbelly, the under, like the normal people, right? There's the stuff happening down the road or next door or in the pub. And I guess the idea of the hybrid between that, the portrait of the kind of rich famous people, the commissioners, and then at the same time him making these paintings that are quite ugly, like often big noses and, you know, scary, grotesque, kind of ghoulish as well. So there's something about that value of valuing both things. I was like, yeah, of course you're doing Franz Hal. Like, Louis, it's so right somehow. It felt really exciting.
Naughty paintings where he's like mad at the regentesses, you know, there's like the regentess is looking really pissed off in a painting, and it's like because he's pissed off at them, because like there's some sort of subversion even when it's just a job commission that he's doing, because all those offices stuff are just to earn money, and then all the ones that are of like people in the pub are the ones he wants to do.
Yeah, for sure. So,
but there's this guy called Henrik Gerrits Pott, who's even better, and also Judith Leister.
She's amazing.
She's amazing.
There's a great one in the National Gallery when everyone can go and see it. And it shows the story of like a girl. Normally the girl's being told off and she's like the shy one, but in this one the girl's the one doing the bad thing and the boy's the one who's like shy, which is great. So even then, like subverting stereotypes of women as well, which is really cool. But it also brings me to like something you said about the idea that you get bored really quickly thinking about audiobooks, that I wanted to talk about the boring talks and being bored and boredom, like especially maybe in the moment a lot of people are like, I'm bored, or there's a sense of staring at a wall a lot more, or like looking out the window. Can you talk about the boring talks and this idea of boredom as a space maybe?
A while ago, or maybe more than 5 years ago now, my friend and my housemate for a little while, Charlotte Young, who is an artist, so she was curating a comedy event called Your Culture is Ailing, Your Art is Dead, and it was really good, and I performed quite a lot of times as part of that series of events that was co-curated by Robin Ince, who is a comedian. And it was thinking about like how art and comedy might kind of overlap, or sometimes I think comedy and comedians are maybe slightly limited by this need to have a laugh every 3 seconds or something ridiculously like kind of pressurized. Whereas as a performance artist who uses humor, you can be weird for a few minutes and not be funny, and you can be sad for a bit. And I think it was that series of events was a way of allowing a bit more of the experimental freedom into comedy practices, but also like allowing humor into performance art practices, which kind of traditionally have been super dry and much more about other emotions rather than like this. Well, people don't take comedy seriously, basically. And obviously, like, it is super serious. It's this like outburst of emotion that is much more raw and less mediated than a more rational or a more kind of, boundaried way of being. So you can't really hide with humour. And so I started doing quite a few performances in a comedy context, and I absolutely loved it. It was like the best thing ever. We got to go to Latitude Festival and basically headline like the last day just for a little 10-minute slot each, but as part of Robin Ince's main thing. So it was really, 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 really cool. And then so from that, James Ward, who curates the Boring Conference each year. Mm-hmm. It's like a kind of alternative comedy, but also just experts in things. So a mixture of comedians and experts who are good at talking about things that are boring, but find interesting. They all come together and they all do short talks over the course of an entire day at Conway Hall. So James Ward curates that, and he was involved in a couple of the Your Culture is Ailing gigs. And he saw my work and heard about like some of the things I was doing about the Argos catalogue, which came from being in the shopping centre, because the Argos catalogue was there. And I was like, wow, this is like the Bible of capitalism. This is so rich in language and imagery that you could spend a whole life studying it as a sort of theologian. I'd worked with the Argos catalogue quite a lot during the Westfield residency, and I'd made a poem out of it by reconfiguring it, which was quite like dark and quite weird. And then I'd got the grime artist Maxter. He had recorded it as a kind of rap, or I don't even know if you say rap, if it's grime, or whether they're like different genres. But anyway, he recorded a spoken word version of my poem, which is really cool. I loved hearing it in a different voice. His voice has got so much more like kind of strength to it than my kind of like fairly weak voice. So I loved hearing that. And then
it's a different pitch as well, isn't it? Because it's somehow much more in the chest, like physically it felt like off the shoulders.
And he's like, that is his medium. He totally understands the voice. He totally understands like the rhythm of it. And I just thought, oh wow, like I need to do the amount of work that he's done on learning about the voice, because I think that's a real, like, there's still so much stuff that I have to learn and that I need to work on, like, that I'm not anywhere near good at. Yeah, and so when you meet someone who's, like, a craftsperson in a particular medium, it's really exciting. So the boring talks, I think it was the first one I did was about the Argos catalogue, and it was just a like 10 to 20 minute kind of slideshow where I talked about things I'd found in the archives of the Argos catalogue and tried to weave them together and relate them to the Whole Earth catalogue, which is a 60s counterculture book of tools, they called it, and it was a sort of hippie tome that was advising people how they could be self-sufficient and opt out, I guess, of mainstream culture. And because that, the Whole Earth catalogue, which is amazing, that was founded by someone called Stuart Brand, I think, and he is associated with like the pioneers of the internet. So like Silicon Valley and hippie counterculture were born of the same moment. And some people went off on one on LSD and the others went off on one on the internet, which was another way of kind of extending the senses and kind of creating a new world where there wouldn't be borders. So it was pretty utopian, but then obviously it got monopolized by big giants like Google. So yeah, I really wanted to reread the Argos catalogue through the Whole Earth catalogue and try and kind of create a narrative from all the imagery and sort of, yeah, like work out what the unconscious of this space. What? Oh, sorry, Sue's just going to say it. Emergency.
Thanks, Sylvie.
Just in a second. I'll just wait until she gets water.
It's very hot.
It is. Rereading the Argos catalogue through the Whole Earth catalogue and trying to like extrapolate some kind of narrative of maybe what's really going on. Like, often quite dark stuff, like the weird thing of all the kids' toys enacting kind of fairly boring stuff that adults do. Like there's loads of hoovers, there's loads of like washing machines that kids can use. There's loads of also kind of like adult jobs that maybe like police officer costumes and stuff for kids. And
I remember in the Argos catalogue wanting that the doll that wheeze and poos. I never got it.
Well,
do you remember that doll?
Maybe that was like... your birthday. When's your birthday?
But it was one of those things where it was actually, I think it was adapted from something that they used to give to teenagers just to prevent them, like to basically be like, this is how bad it is. Like, wow. And it was like this thing that cried. And there's loads of books, like fiction books written about it too. And then it became like a really popular toy. That people...
They still have it.
Yeah, I'm sure. But like how, I just think that was really weird as well. That for me, when you were doing this project, was like, oh God, yeah, I remember that doll thing and why there was such a desire to, like an adult, this adult kind of life was being like lived in miniature or something.
Yeah, it's all so psychological and so kind of like Freudian and psychoanalytical when you look at it. Because like, it's not like, so... I guess like marketing taps into our most basic desires that are things that have evolved for thousands and thousands of years and millions of years. And so like they're not kind of just things that a marketing person has invented. Like a marketing person has to identify a need and then respond to a need rather than inventing something and then saying, how do I get people to want it? So when we buy something, we're buying our own desires. I guess that's like a thing that John Berger says in that Ways of Seeing book that we're all supposed to read being art. But it is really true. Like the advert offers you, he says, the advert offers you an image of yourself with the Rolex and then forever you're without the Rolex. It's like a kind of lack, that kind of, is it a Lacan thing of this thought that kind of, yeah, you're without... you then become lacking in something and you kind of, the only way you can become whole again is to is to buy the Rolex,
to possess it. Yeah And I think it's making me it's sounding a little bit, I guess, that there's a cynicism there to this, but there's also in your work a real joy and like optimism. And I just wondered if you could talk about the positive, like you're not just saying this is all awful and critiquing it in a way that you just want it all to disappear. Can you talk about the positivity as well, I mean, or not, but yeah, that's how it feels.
Yeah, it's like the joy and rage of being a hypocrite and being like a sort of fallible, weak, like impulsive human thing. And I really love the shopping centre. I'm really excited by it. It has like every possibility. It's all kind of for free unless you take it away. Like, so you can still use everything in the shopping centre, and it wants you to enjoy it. It's like a sensory theme park. And you're then supposed to buy it, but if you don't, you can kind of have it all. And so, yeah, I was really attracted to a lot of the sensations and kind of creativity of that space. And in all of my work, there's this sort of tension between like rage and joy and not really being able to understand, because it's not like I'm above any of that. Like, I really want like the latest trainers, and I'm always trying to wrestle with the conflicting desires. And so, yeah, I guess it's about distance between me and the thing that I'm observing, and trying to make sure that there is no distance. Like, when I'm angry at it, I'm angry at myself. Like, but I'm also loving the rebellion against the worthiness as well, and sort of baiting myself through the pursuit of the joy of the thing. So I'll always be kind of so close to the subject matter that love and hate go together. Like, the parent that you fight with the most will be the parent that you're closest to, because there's a clash. And so, yeah, there's some sort of like clashing that would go on that is because I am emotionally involved with the subject, so I'm not able to distance. And I think that's really important. And also, like, I was having a tutorial in like 2001 or something, when I was on my BA, with Mark Dean, who's an artist and the chaplain of the of UAL, and he was my tutor, and I was making work that was like kind of failing to overthrow capitalism through like futile gestures in public space, even at the time. And then he said, it's best when it is generous. And I really held on to that. And I think like that generosity opens things up. Like, if you, like, sometimes I talk about this story, this school assembly story, where it's like the guys, there's a guy with a coat on walking through the landscape, and the wind and the sun are having a fight, trying to get him to take the jacket off. Oh, but you can't get him to take the jacket off. And the wind tries to blow the jacket off for ages, and it's like he's just getting stronger, and like the guy's putting the jacket on more closely because he's like really cold. And then the sun just is like, right, okay, and shines a little bit, and the guy takes his jacket off. I think like defensiveness is the enemy, like, and guilt is the enemy. And a lot of kind of worthy anti-capitalist rhetoric is about like guilt and, yeah, like making us feel defensive, and that shuts down the possibility for change. So for me, like, opening it up and say, and kind of using humor and using pleasure, because like I want all the pleasure. And I think often kind of well, like, movements which have been more socialist have tended towards shutting down pleasure. So like, if you're living in a communist sort of state dictatorship thing, you all have to wear a really boring outfit, like, and you have really limited choice about what you can eat. Like, couldn't we have loads of choice and individuality and expression and difference and also have a socialist way of sharing stuff? So for me, that's like, it's about removing any form of control and any form of like hierarchy from a system. That's the way that you allow for sharing and equality, and but also like difference and yeah, freedom. I really want freedom. That's like, I have a lot of freedom, but I think we have to enact freedom in every possible way all the time. Like, we have a responsibility. As a person that's pretty much been really privileged in so many ways, for all of my life, really, my responsibility is to enact freedom and against any form of like mini little like control system, because if we don't like flex it, it's like this morning when I was doing yoga, I'm not flexible at all because I haven't used that muscle. So we can't be complacent about freedom. We have to, like, it's a practice that you keep up to in tiny bits, not by like grand gestures, but through like little micro acts of resistance.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's really powerful and important and brilliant way of putting it. And something that seems like it's come to the fore in your relationship with education through the many years and many different versions of that, which gone through being at different institutions, setting up an alternative art school, kind of leaving that to run itself, setting up lots of other things along the way that sort of feel like a form of school, or form of alternative education at least, and then now teaching at Goldsmiths. So I wonder if you could talk about education as maybe part of that, or as an extension of that, or your relationship with education to education.
Yeah, like education is utopia. Art school is utopia. We always have to keep resisting the marketization of higher education, which I guess is kind of a reality, but also, like, what does art school really need? It just needs people to be there in the same space, to commit to being there. Sometimes it takes some kind of qualification to validate that, but actually we can validate that ourselves by saying it's worth being there in a room together for an amount of time and mm-hmm. seeing what happens. You may need a room, but you already live in a room, so we've already got all of the tools that we need, really. We just have to create a commitment to shared learning. And so when I just first graduated from my BA, and I wanted to do an MA, but in fact, I had done an evening course MA in cultural studies, but it was exhausting to work full time and do that. And I really wanted to have a space for my art practice. My friend Lucy Gallon, who co-founded Altum FA with me, she also wanted to do an art MA, but we couldn't afford to, and we were working full time. We worked at the same place as artist assistants to Damien Hirst, and we could talk during the day, but like we really needed something that was more than just, like, we organised lots of group shows, but you'd stick them up and then you'd just go and no one would ever talk in any depth. People would just have a beer in front of the work and not even really look at it. So we needed this space for, like, kind of learning and thinking. And otherwise you just feel, like, really isolated because it's like you're just making work and no one's ever really properly engaging with it. So, we started Altum FA in 2010, so it's now 10 years old this year. And
wow,
yeah, it's quite amazing. And it's just self, like, it has loads of different members, new people come and go all the time, and some people have been in it for ages, some people are really new. There is no kind of, ideally most of the time there is no hierarchy between the newest person and the oldest person, and it's, I think, because it is really needed. Like, artists never stop learning, we can't stop learning, art school doesn't end. It's just art school teaches you how to have the skills to make your own art school for the rest of your life. I will dip in and out of Altum FA as and when I need it. But it's great to know that that it kind of runs itself with the help of lots of people. Like, Sadie Edginton is very active in it and has been for many years. So she's one of those, like, catalysts that keeps it alive, and loads of other people in the group are stepping up when others are tired. And it's because it's only one night a week on Monday nights, it's got this, and because it doesn't have gatekeepers, like, anyone can join, you just have to find out about it and then email them, it has this really nice sort of feeling that it's a bonus, and so there's no resentment most of the time, no resentment when people can't commit totally, or like, it's a bit different to sometimes in collectives where someone takes on loads of work and then might feel a bit hard done by because of that.
Yeah.
I think it's only one night a week for a few hours, so there's nothing to lose, really. There's only an opportunity. And if you put in, you get a ton out. And if you don't, then you don't. Like, so it really kind of works. And it's sort of really simple, actually. But it's different in an institution. There's loads of good things about that. There's loads of, like, things that maybe I'd like to change about that. But the thing that's great about Goldsmiths is we still have this really luxurious thing of the really long tutorial one-to-one session. So I get to a depth with my students that I would never get to in any other institution. It's like after half an hour you've talked to each other and you're like, you feel like, oh, I've squeezed all of it out of this conversation. And then you go to the next level and it's like, oh, there's actually a whole nother bit here that we're only just scratching. So it's a discipline that's, it's really hard. It's really hard doing 8 to 45 minute tutorials in a day. Like, my brain is flying. But it is hard to get to some level of depth, and I get so much out of that personally. It takes away a load of energy, but it like gives back more in return.
I always think of that, it's not a very good comparison, but the Green Mile, where that guy like sucks out all the stuff from the person and then he like sits with it, but somehow it makes him stronger eventually. Well, it's a terrible metaphor because it ends really.
That's like a great Emma, like really good painting.
And it ends up being a bit gross and everyone dies, but that's not really what I mean. I mean, it's like draining in a really specific way, but it's your head. I find the same thing. I'm so excited at the end of a day's tutorials, but physically quite exhausted. And it's a really interesting combination and tension that it can only exist maybe after that specific encounter for that long, type of encounter.
Yeah, definitely. It's like anything, like running a marathon, which I could probably never do because my toes would turn black and fall off, like even if I run like a shorter distance. But I'm just looking down at them now and like my little toenail is like gone completely black and it looks like it's hanging on. But like that discipline of just, you're like, you think you can't go any further, but you just have to like find strength from somewhere. It is really hard being an artist. And I was talking to students. I did this workshop yesterday called Graduphobia, the fear of graduating, because it's so easy to not think about what happens next and how to survive and thrive as an artist. And I struggled so much with that when I graduated from my BA. Yeah. I just felt the need to create like kind of solutions to that problem that I have always had. And I think most design comes from having a problem and then trying to fix it and hack it and find a kind of DIY way of doing it. And the DIY sort of education formats are, they have things that the other, like everyone is equally invested in it. And there's no passiveness that you might get from if you're consuming a product of a degree. And so it kind of cuts out the possibility of passivity from the outset. So yeah, both are really great. And I think like Altum FA isn't against institutions. It's just saying, right, well, you're doing that and that's great, but one, it's not accessible to everyone. And two, it doesn't, like, art school can't end. We need it the whole time for our whole lives. And three, it's not able to do everything that you need as an artist. So Altum FA fills in that gap, and other things like School of the Damned and lots of other kind of DIY artist-led education formats do that as well. So it's kind of like either and rather than either or, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And speaking of either and, I wanted to ask before we ask the last two questions, maybe there's something, because I really want to hear in something recited by you, something spoken that you've written or that you might want to improvise. And we haven't talked as much about improvisation, but maybe you could just demonstrate. If there's anything you want to read, maybe do you want me to give you a time? How do you want to just do it?
Maybe I'll do like a 5 minute little making something up based on something that I did before but have forgotten. So, you know that bit by the back of the Asda? No, not that bit, the bit up by where there's the hill, and it's not that bit by where there's a Phil Collins cassette and it's all like unraveling and there's the used condom, and you go, it's not that bit there, you go up by that bit there by the back of the Asda where there's all of like the men and they've got like the white aprons, but it's all covered in the blood because of the big cow carcasses and they're delivering them and all the blood's running down, and why isn't their apron red? And then it wouldn't look so much. And it's the bit by, there's, you know, the bit by the back of the Asda, and then there's the vent, and it's at the side of where the fried chicken shop, and there's the man there, and he's just inhaling the vapours of the flesh out the back of the, he's inhaling all from the vent, and you look down at the man's hand, and there's a string, and on the end of the string, there's a dog, and the dog's wearing the man's glasses, and the dog's looking over at the, it's like, it used to be the McDonald's, but it's closed down, and it's, there's all like whitewashed out of the windows, and the builders have scraped a little, is it like a picture of the devil? Yeah, but it's in reverse, and they've written, you can't, it's sort of expletives backwards. So, and the man's kind of reading the expletives backwards, he's rapping like reverse cursing that. And you can sort of smell, it might not be him, it might be like the vapours of the flesh he's inhaling, and all of like the blood from all the carcasses is sort of, it's kind of running around by the back of the Asda on that bit where there's the detergent as well, and it's like the mixture of the smell of the blood and the detergent, and it's not actually that bit there, it's the bit by where there's a bin, and but it's overflowing, and then the Uber drivers, you know, like when they throw out the bottles of yellow liquid from their windows. So it's like that, but there's one of those bottles and it's balanced on the top of the bin, but everything's kind of teetering and it's just about to fall. And why didn't they just put the bottle by the side of the bin anyway? But they can't, because it would be littering. So it's that bit there by, you know, like actually where there's the shop and you go in and you say, do you sell buttonholes? And they say, oh no, we only sell buttons. And you say, but I want to catch a pearly king. How am I going to catch a pearly king if I don't have buttonholes, because I want them to be able to like walk past me when I'm in the East End, and then like all the buttons will get caught in my costume that's made of buttonholes. And they say, but we don't sell buttonholes, we only sell donut holes and buttons. And so you're like, oh, it's not even there. When it's not even then, you're like running up all the hill, like trying to find where it actually is. It's not that bit there. It's that other bit there. And there's all the mattresses in the way. And then so like you're bouncing over the mattresses, and it's a bit like Mario, but there's no gold that comes up. It's just like plumes of syphilitic dust that come up as you bounce over it, and you pass like where there's the Jehovah's Witness woman saying to you, do you want to like maybe meet up? And you're saying, but I didn't know if your religion accepted people who are gay. And she's saying, oh, do you want to come for a coffee? And you're thinking that's a really fast conversion that you've done there. That's all on the way that you're going up, and you're trying to find a bit by the back of the Asda, and it's like, it's not actually that bit there, it's the other bit, you know, by in fact, they've taken it down now, the council. There was a sort of a big sign, but they've removed it. It's just like emptiness now, but not even emptiness, just like that bit, like, you know, Tate Modest, the tape that's in your head where it has all the things that you could have made, but you didn't want to because you were too scared of what people would think, that bit there. Like, so now it's just like Tate Modest. It's totally a big blank space. Not even like a white space, but just an invisible space, because the council's taken away the sign that has the quote by William Morris on it. And it says, the true secret of happiness is to take great pleasure in the details of everyday life. That's it. Thank you.
Oh, that's so good. Brilliant. I had to turn my speaker because I was laughing. but I also realised I just actually... thank you for doing it so brilliant. Oh, have I gone away? Can you hear me?
For like half a second, just repeat that last bit.
Oh, just that I asked you to, I realised I'd asked you to demonstrate improvisation, which is quite an ask on a podcast. So I think you did. That was amazing.
Well, Well, I have done that, like, versions of, that's just bits of stuff I've done before. It's all in your head. It's really, like, everything is in your head as a little protein strand, even, like, Yvette Fielding's Most Haunted. And if you just say that, it triggers that and it reactivates that strand. So the mind
I think that's what's amazing.
Yeah.
The mind
is amazing.
I think it's also what I'm always so excited by with performance and live performance and improvised spoken word is that when what that does to you as a listener is it takes you on your own personal journey. So everyone's version of Behind Asda already has loads of information. It's like loaded with my personal history and inherited information. So that was really, really awesome. Thank you so much. It's delicious.
You're so interested in the back of the Asda.
I am. I mean, my studio face is Asda, so I actually watch the back of Asda quite a lot. Quite an interesting spot.
This podcast is brought to you by Asda.
Yeah, exactly. There are other supermarkets available.
I like the history. You know, the first Tesco, really quickly, the first Tesco is that one in Hackney by, like, Hackney Central. And it used to be called T.E. Stockwell and Cohen. And Asda is Associated Dairies. So it's just a fact.
I love it. Nice. Great knowledge. On that note, so I always end by asking two questions, and I'm going to ask you the same too. So the first one is, if you can suggest anything that might be helpful, that has been helpful to you, that might be helpful to other people during this time.
For me, just like running, cycling, Hackney Marshes, Walthamstow Marshes, get out and listen to the sounds of nature, but also listen to the theme from E.T., while cycling.
I'm obsessed with E.T. at the moment.
Well, like, my friends, my neighbours are really close and it's really lovely. And one of my neighbours said her mum in Scotland has a new radio show because she's retired as a nurse. And so she's made a radio show about, like, a journey to space. And she's curated loads of classical music that's on that theme. So I listened to that and I just found myself speeding through the marshes with the E.T. theme on, and it was just the best thing ever. So I think just get out, or always get out, and I've been, like, enjoying all my local produce from Walthamstow places. Like, there's the local honey man, he is great. Like, you can buy honey from him. Crafty apple cider, I've been having some of that. There's a community cafe in the park near me, and it used to be a cafe, but now it's like a shop where you can buy amazing stuff. So, like, my local community, we made a museum of the street where everyone put an object outside, and then we socially distantly went around and, like, read all the information that we'd written about each object. It was so cool. So there's always...
I'm literally like, where do you live? This sounds amazing. Yeah, I was fascinated in that idea.
It's the, like, Republic of Walthamstow. And yeah, they're all really amazing, my street. So that's really helped. And my cat and my girlfriend. I mean, that is sometimes that helps. Sometimes it's really stressful, but I'm sure everyone has that, because it's like, you don't sign up to spend 24/7 with someone. Like, but yeah, this is the real, like, crucible,
the real deal
testing. But yeah, so just like calling my mum and the usual stuff, like normal stuff, and gardening. My cat.
That's loads. Yeah. Amazing. And have you learnt something about yourself?
I guess, like, probably that I'm perfectly primed practice-wise for this moment, because my work is so much about, like, domestic spaces and, yeah, like, specific situations anyway. So, like, I've realised I can adapt and I can make something out of nothing. So, like, I can always cook something better with leftovers. So, like, I think I knew it already, but I know that all artists are uniquely resourceful people. Like, that's what art school teaches you, how to adapt and how to be resourceful. So I thought maybe when this struck and when it became, like, clear it was a big thing, that it would mean that art wasn't relevant. And I'd think, oh, this is stupid. But, like, really, really instantly, I knew that it was more important than ever. And it's been the art thinking and the creative thinking that's kept my street going. And we've been much more active as artists. Like everyone on my street is now an artist in some way. There's a concert every week. There's actually two. There's a guy that sings on the street on Thursday nights. Yeah, and there's a guy who plays piano and he opens all his windows and you can like sit on the windowsill and like classical piano concerts. So there's one again on Sunday for Eid. And yeah, it's like really cool. So like everyone is an artist now. And I hope that when people go back to normal, like that everyone sticks with being an artist, because it's like really important and anyone can be one. And yeah, inhibitions are not necessary. So
maybe we need a workshop. We talked about this a little bit, but this idea of how to leave lockdown, like I think there's a big like question mark over all that as well. So maybe that's something that we can develop something for, or do a second chat or something.
You have to work out how to leave, because I think part of all of us doesn't really want to leave the new kind of like the release from expectation that we've been given, which as kind of career artists, I mean, like I don't know, it still feels like a weird thing to say because my work isn't like very commercial, but yeah, like it's a very high pressured job, really. It's sort of an impossible career, really. And so yeah, I've really enjoyed the fact that there's been a release from expectation and you can set your own expectations of yourself. It's the difference between running with an app that tells you to keep going and to do a certain thing, and then kind of wild running, which I much prefer. And I more
with... like Phoebe from Friends.
Really? Yeah. Well, I don't know, but like, yeah, I think I have an affinity with her. So yeah, maybe.
Amazing, amazing. Cycling to ET. Thank you so much. That was amazing.
Yeah, that was so nice. Thanks so much for being so generous and listening, like giving me the chance to think through thoughts, because it's so important. And we often don't we don't make time to do this. So you're making time for lots of us to do this. We just need to make time for you to do that. So if you want anyone to interview you, then, well, I mean, you could get us all to do it, couldn't you?
I could have like a year's worth of interviews with me. Well, it's been amazing. I feel like I've learned loads and I can't wait to just read everything I've scribbled. So thank you so much and listen to it again.
Yeah,
and if we want to see more of your stuff, obviously we'll put some links to various things that you mentioned. You went through loads of things that have happened and loads of great institutions that have supported those things. So we'll put links to those. But your Instagram is?
I think it's LouiseAshcroft1.
Perfect, Louise Ashcroft one, and website is exciting and like very dynamic and vibrant. So I encourage you all to look at that, which is, I think it's just louiseashcroft.org,
because I'm an organisation.
Wow.
Right. Well, there's another Louise Ashcroft who's really cool, and she's an opera singer, so she has .com.
Oh, amazing! Plug for her as well. All right, brilliant. Thanks so much. Take care, and I hope to see you soon. And maybe come to the marshes. I'll come up there.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Lovely. All right, go see you soon.
Hey, lots of love. Bye.
Bye.